The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm the person everyone thinks of when they're asked what they're thankful for. Bill Curtis. And here is your host at the Studebaker Theater in the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Oh, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We're all excited. Yes, it is Thanksgiving when people gather with family and express their gratitude that they no longer have to argue about the 2024 election. No, I'm kidding. We'll argue about it till we die. But still, when it comes time for us to express our thanks, we go right to the fact that we've been doing this show for more than a quarter century. And despite that history, interesting people still agree to come on and subject themselves to our games.
For example, Eric Wyon-Mayor, a man who climbed the tallest building on every continent and had many other adventures despite being blind. But as we discussed, when he joined us in June, he was perhaps most famous for something else entirely.
We first heard about you from a video that went viral in 2006, and we're going to play it for our audience. This is just a local newscast with someone who is announcing that they're going to interview you. Let's just listen.
After the break, we're going to interview Eric Wyon-Mayor, who climbed the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest. But he's gay. I mean, he's gay. Excuse me, he's blind. So we'll talk about that.
Okay. Yeah. So, couple questions. I assume you've heard that before.
I've heard it a thousand times.
Yeah.
But what they didn't realize, they think it's funny, but I'm like, no way, man, you made my career. No one heard about climbing Everest, but everyone heard about my gay video.
So I guess now that we've established that, I should say, first of all, happy Pride. Secondly,
thank you.
So this local news anchor was going to interview you about your achievement of being the first blind person to climb Everest. Were you standing by as that was said? Did you, like, hear her say that? And did you have to...
Yeah, there's another clip where if you go online, you can see me just completely laughing, cracking up for... I couldn't even do the interview. And by the way, I just want to say for the NPR audience, nothing funny about being gay or being blind, but I don't know how the two look the same on a strip.
When you have to introduce yourself, you say, well, yes, I'm Eric Wyon-Mayor. I climbed Mount Everest, first blind person to do it, first blind person to climb the seven summits, and there's still nothing, and you're like, I'm blind, not gay. And then they go, you!
No. In fact, I like more records than I can get. You know, like, first blind guy to climb Everest, first blind gay man to climb Everest is even better. So I'll take it.
Which also, you actually raised another question. Somewhere out there is the first gay man to climb Mount Everest, and he must be thinking, well, gee, he didn't get the credit. That Wyon-Mayor guy.
Rooked.
Yeah, I know.
I stole his thunder.
You did. Now that we have covered that, I actually want to talk to you about the actually impressive things that you did. There might be people out there who say, oh, he's a blind guy who climbed Everest. I guess he just was roped to some guy who did the climbing. No. You do it by feel, right?
Yeah, and I did have great guides, though. I mean, like on Everest, I had we had 12 friends and 8 Sherpas on our team. And those guys were helping me get through, like, the Khumbu Icefall. I mean, the Khumbu Icefall is right out of base camp on Everest, and it's a blind person's worst nightmare. It doesn't meet Americans with Disability Act standards. I mean, so they were ringing jingling a bell in front of me and talking to me and telling me which ropes to clip into. So for sure, blind guys, at least as far as I know, don't climb Everest alone. And I owe my team everything.
I'm sure you get this a lot. When I think about climbing mountains, which is not something I have done, but I think if I were to do it, it would be for the view, which is not relevant to you. So what is the appeal to you to do this remarkable alpine climbing?
I'm sensing my body moving up the ice, swinging my tool into the ice, kicking my feet into the ice, feeling the wind and the sun on my face. And when I get to the summit, you're so high, blind people use this kind of skill called echolocation. And it's the idea of sound vibrations moving out through space and bouncing off of objects and coming back at you. And when you're up high on a summit, those sound vibrations just move out infinitely through space. It's sort of like you've been swallowed by sky. And it's this scary, infinite, beautiful, powerful sound of vibrations just moving through the universe. And so I'm getting a lot of scenery. It's just not visual.
They made, like I said, your career and your life has been documented in documentaries and in one feature film about you going up to the top of Everest. That must have been a little odd, having a movie made about you while you're still here.
Well, even odder, I was the this guy Peter Facinelli played me. And so they asked me to be the stuntman for Peter. So that, I think, was a first in history, because it was a story about me played by Peter, and I was the stuntman for Peter. Yeah. I don't know. It was really weird.
So Peter, this actor, is playing you. How handsome did he tell you he was?
He was way handsomer than me. I heard he's a real handsome man, so...
It occurs to me, if you asked me, like, well, how handsome is Peter, who plays me in the movie, I would be stuck, because if I say, well, he's very handsome, would that be flattering you?
You could play me for sure. I think you'd, from what I understand, you'd have to put a wig on, though.
Maybe two wigs.
I'm just... I'm so disappointed. Who told you? Because this entire conversation, I have felt so free and unburdened for the first time in years.
Blind people, you know, we're judgy, but we have to get the information in another way.
Was it the echoes coming off the top of his head?
Well, Eric Weinmeier, it is a pleasure to talk to you. We've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Mountain Climber Meets Social Climber.
So since you're an accomplished mountain climber, we thought we'd ask you about another kind of climber, social climbers, people who are trying to rise above their station in society. Answer 2 out of 3 questions correctly, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, the voice of their choice, from our show on their voicemail. Bill, who is Eric playing for?
Lilac Rain Thompson of Black Mountain, North Carolina.
Lilac Rain Thompson. All right, Eric, here is your first question. Two of the most famous social climbers in recent history were Tariq and Michaela Salahi, who famously crashed a 2009 White House state dinner to which they were not invited. Now, what did Ms. Salahi go on to do after that? Was it A, she joined the CIA as an infiltration expert, B, she became a life coach promising to help clients, quote, get past any velvet rope holding you back, or C, she left her husband to marry the founder of the rock band Journey in a wedding broadcast live on pay-per-view?
Wow, the third one sounds so specific, maybe I'll go B.
Wait a minute. I'm just going to go through.
No, I'm going C.
All right, there you go. Lightning reflexes. Yes, it is C. She ran off. One day, her husband, Tariq, filed a missing persons report because he didn't know where she was. It turns out she had ran off with Neil Schon, co-founder of Journey, and she eventually married him in a pay-per-view event in 2013. They are still, apparently, happily married.
Wow.
I know.
Wow. Just a small town girl. Sneak into the White House.
All right, next question. A woman named Rachel Lee loved celebrity style, and she wanted to dress just like her favorite celebrity fashion icon. So she did what? A, she created a wearable digital screen that could display images of any look she wanted. B, she sent every celebrity a version of her favorite dress, so eventually they'd be copying her. Or C, she just broke into celebrities' houses and stole the outfits she liked.
I'll go A.
You're going to go with A. No, it was actually C. She broke into their homes and stole their outfits.
What?
She did. This was a big deal. She and her accomplices became known as the Bling Ring.
Oh, should have known.
Yeah. Here's the funny thing, too. What, their first victim was Paris Hilton because they figured Paris Hilton would never lock her door, and they were right. All right, last question. If you win this, you have summited one of the most famous social climbers of recent years was Anna Delvey. She pretended to be a wealthy heiress as she scammed other people out of money to fund her lifestyle. After her conviction for fraud, which of these did she really say when a reporter visited her at Rikers Island Prison? Was it A, I'd be lying to you if I said I was sorry for anything? B, would you mind loaning me $75,000? I'm good for it. Or C, the last thing I remember is hitting my head on a car door in 2012. Where am I?
A sounds kind of plausible.
You're going to go for A?
All right, we'll do it.
You're going to go for A. All right, yes, it was A. I'd be lying to you if I said I was sorry for anything.
Yeah.
These people must have seen the Netflix series about her. Bill, how did Eric Weinmeier do in our quiz?
He got 2 out of 3, and that's enough for a win.
I'm so excited. I feel like I just summited the 7 summits all over again.
And it was easier.
Yeah.
Go enjoy your peanut.
And I did it on my couch.
It did, exactly. Eric Weinmeier is an adventurer, activist, speaker, and the first blind man to summit Mount Everest, but not, despite what you've heard, the first gay one. Eric Weinmeier, thank you. Thank you for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What a great pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Bye, Eric.
Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, baby, there ain't no mountain high enough. Thanks, everybody. So, as you are all listening to this, we are lying around in a tryptophan haze from our Thanksgiving meal, reminiscing about all the amazing people we got to talk to this year.
And since we consider you family, we're going to share a few of them with you, but don't hog them like you did the sweet potatoes.
For example, here's something we're broadcasting for the very first time. In late August of this year, we went to Minneapolis and we did a show that we broadcast that week. But then we did another show the next night, really just as an excuse to stick around and spend a day at the Minnesota State Fair.
Did you know that chocolate chip cookies come in a bucket?
But the show we did that day was terrific. Here's some of it, starting with a round of Bluff the Listener with panelists Alzo Slade, Emmy Blotnick, and Shantira Jackson. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hey, this is Cassidy from Durham, North Carolina.
Hello, Cassidy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you do there in Durham?
I am doing my clinical rotations in my last year of pharmacy school.
Your last year of pharmacy school. That's really cool. Can I ask, I'm genuinely curious, what's the most important thing about being a good pharmacist?
I would say making sure that we have patients on the most affordable medications. I would say that's the biggest impact we make.
Okay. I would have guessed not poisoning people, but...
That's important, too.
Well, Cassidy, welcome to the show. You, of course, are going to play the game in which you have to try to tell truth from fiction. Bill, what is Cassidy's topic?
Bring your child to work day.
Bringing your child to work, always a special occasion, right? You get to share all the joys of your workplace with your little one. You get to show them how to submit an expense report and why they should never trust the office milk. But this week, we heard about a child who was brought to work and made quite an impression there. Our panelists are going to tell you about it. Pick the one who's telling the truth, and you will win the Wait Waiter of your choice on your voicemail. Are you ready to play?
Yes.
All right. First, let's hear from Emmy Blotnick.
Brain surgery can be a tricky thing. And that's true even if you are a brain surgeon. But it's especially true if you are the 13-year-old child of a brain surgeon and your mom hands you the drill. This was the nightmare scenario that played out during a patient's brain surgery in the Austrian city of Graz last January. Thankfully, the doctor was fired. But how was this ever allowed to happen? The conversation between the brain surgeon mother and her 13-year-old non-brain surgeon kid may have gone something like this. Kid, hey, mom, are you sure you want me to use a drill for the first time on a living person? Maybe I should start somewhere low stakes, like the foot? Mom, nah, do the skull. Kid, hey, by the way, who is this guy? Mom, you can ask him when, I mean, if he wakes up. Now, don't focus too much and drill, baby, drill.
A brain surgeon brings her daughter to work and lets her drill a hole into the patient's skull. Your next story of some kid commotion comes from Alzo Slade.
With Georgia's state election board again grabbing headlines, some new information has come to light regarding the 2020 election. A new investigation had proved there was, in fact, tampering with the ballots in 2020. A Republican election official in Valdosta brought their 9-year-old Simon to work on election day to show him real-life democracy in action. However, after coming to the conclusion that democracy is boring, Simon pulled out his arts and crafts to entertain himself. Within minutes, he had an idea to liven up the voting process by creating ballots of his own. Turns out there were only 20 ballots that had to be thrown out after they found glitter, Elmer's glue, and construction paper with one question written on it in crayon. Will you go out with me, yes or no?
An election official in Georgia brings his kid to work and he actually introduces election fraud. Your last Office OMG comes from Shantira Jackson.
A jeweler in Southern California was accused of stealing his customers' jewelry when it was discovered that boxes that were supposed to contain priceless items were swapped out and replaced without his knowledge. It turns out that his 7-year-old daughter was making friendship bracelets for an upcoming Taylor Swift concert. And when she saw how boring all the jewelry her dad was selling looked, she decided to pull them out of their velvet boxes and swap them with more festive and colorful Taylor-themed friendship bracelets. When asked why she would do such a thing, she simply claimed that she didn't think diamonds were a girl's best friend because every girl's best friend is Taylor.
All right, here are your choices. Somewhere, somebody brought their kid to work and something went wrong. Was it from Emmy Blotnick, a brain surgeon who let their daughter, just, you know, for the experience of it, drill a hole in a patient's brain? From Alzo Slade, an election official who brought a kid to the counting house and he ended up, shall we say, forging documents and ballots? Or from Shantira Jackson, a jeweler's kid who decided that what those Beverly Hills type people needed was not diamonds and rubies, but Taylor Swift friendship bracelets. Which of these was the real story of a kid coming to work and messing things up?
I'm going to go with the brain surgeon.
You're going to go with the brain surgeon?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, that's a good choice. Well, to bring you the correct answer, we spoke to someone who reported on the real story.
I'd generally be mad if anybody was drilling into my head. If they didn't wake up and find out that it was a 13-year-old girl, I would hope that she at least watched some YouTube videos about it or something.
Watch some YouTube.
That was Louis Prada, a writer from Vice, who reported on the junior brain surgeon in Vienna. Congratulations, Cassidy. You got it right. You earned a point for Emmy just for telling the truth and for acting out the scenario. Thank you, Emmy. But you have also won our prize, any voice from our show you might choose.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. She shot a hole in my
soul. And then, since the Paris Olympics had just ended, we decided to talk to an actual Olympian about what it was like.
And now the game we call Not My Job. The best thing about this summer's Paris Olympics was that thanks to streaming, you could watch any sport you liked, and the best sport to watch was weightlifting. No, like, complicated tricks with weird names, no incomprehensible judging, just people picking up enormous weights or not. In the course of just 4 years, Mary Tyson Lappin went from complete rookie to Olympian weightlifter representing the U.S. at the Paris Games. She grew up just over the border in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. We're delighted to have her with us here. Mary Tyson Lappin, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I wasn't kidding. I watched weightlifting because I was able to.
Yeah.
Thank God you finally got some attention. And I was fascinated because I don't understand the first thing about it. So let's start at the basics. You pick up weights, is that right? You lift them.
Yes.
Okay.
Obviously there's a little bit more to it than that, but at the end of the day, it's a very, like, simple sport. Like,
yeah.
It's whoever lifts the most weight wins the meet, and you want to try to be as strong as you can, and that's who gets to win.
So in the Olympic weightlifting, there's basically two different events.
Yes.
And you're going to say them because I can't without blushing.
Okay, so we snatch. And then we clean and jerk.
You snatch and clean and jerk.
Yes, the snatch is from the floor, and you're going straight over your head without stopping. The clean and jerk is you're going to clean it, pull it to your shoulders, take a little rest, a break. Not a break. It's like a second.
Yeah.
And take your
breath.
You
don't stop and go get a cup of coffee and come back.
You take a 1 second rest, or basically enough to recover and get your breath, and then you push it over your head. So typically you clean and jerk heavier because you get that little short rest, and that's the lift. You add the two up, and that's your total, that's your score, and that's where you decipher where you're going to place.
In the off season, where you don't lift weights at a regular gym. Like, you're not at 24-hour fitness or nothing, right?
No. There are people that go to gyms like that, but most of us have, like, weightlifting gyms where it's, like, people doing kind of what we're doing, because it gets kind of distracting at times, and I try to avoid it because I get, like, kind of embarrassed in gyms.
Well, I'm
like
about
that.
To say, but Mary, you never get the temptation to just walk into a
24-hour
fit and just flex on these fools.
I never ever do.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you should walk into like a 24-hour fitness with your USA singlet on and be like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I do not get the temptation. Yeah, some people do.
Some gym bro standing there with 250-pound barbells, and you pick him and them up at the same time and put them back in the rack.
Yeah,
that would
put
be
him
awesome.
Back in his car.
Speaking of stupid questions, does anybody, like, for example, oh, my God, you're an Olympic weightlifter. Could you pick that up? And they point to some object near you.
Yeah, all the time.
Right.
Like, do you think you could lift that? I'm like, well, yeah.
Can I ask you a little bit about the Olympics?
Yes.
So you got to be on the boat in the boat parade.
Yes,
was
that
fun? It looked like fun.
Yeah.
It was raining.
It was raining. It was fun. I will say it's fun. I'm not going to say it wasn't fun. It's not what I imagined. We had all those like AI-generated images before the Olympics where the sunset was beautiful and everyone was cheering, and like we saw the Eiffel Tower and everything, and then we get there and it was gray.
Yeah.
And it was wet, and we had these jeans on and a wool jacket, and we're all soaking wet. And I don't think Ralph Lauren had any idea we were going to have 99-cent ponchos over our $2,000 outfits.
Right. Wait a minute. Are you, in fact, you just pointed to your jeans. Are you, those are the
These
jeans.
Are my opening ceremony jeans.
Those are your opening, those are genuine Ralph Lauren.
Yeah. Yeah.
Design.
Yep.
Opening ceremony jeans. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Are they worth $2,000?
Well, I think the jeans are like $400.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
wow.
But the whole outfit was like $2,000.
Right. Yeah, that jacket. I looked it up.
I know.
Because I wanted it.
It's in the car. Yeah. I got mine in the car.
Can I see it?
It's in the car.
So, sorry.
And I've always... I've also wondered, did you get to hang with LeBron? I'm sure everybody asked.
Well, I have a picture with LeBron, but it wasn't on purpose. I was in the background. And someone
You photobombed LeBron James.
Someone took it, and it was after it started raining, and he had a nice poncho, and my hair was soaking wet on my face, and I was like looking at him. So I won't share the picture because I look really silly.
Well, wait a minute, Mary, to be clear, LeBron James has a picture with you.
And you got to do one of those promotions, those little cute movies that NBC did with Snoop Dogg.
Yep.
And just like Michael Phelps, for example, taught Snoop Dogg sort of to swim, you taught Snoop to lift.
Yes.
How did that go?
He actually did a pretty good job. I pretty much just... Everyone asked me what my strategy was because they said I did a good job. So I said my strategy was basically coaching a kid that's never touched a barbell before.
Probably was.
And he did a really good job.
Coaching a kid who's never touched a barbell and is stoned.
Yes.
Well, that's what you just do. You're just like, Snoop, imagine this barbell is a 25-pound joint.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
No, but that doesn't work, also, because at the end you have to drop it.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, you see what you're saying.
He did a really good job. He wanted to lift more weight than I would let him.
All right.
And I said, I think it's a terrible idea. Let's stick with the little ones. And then he asked if his producers would crop big weights in, and I think I did see a video of that.
Really? Just to get a sense, so Snoop Dogg is a grown man.
Yes.
How much weight did you have him lift?
First, we started with a broomstick.
Oh, I saw that. So you had him lift his body weight.
Yes.
And he's a skinny fellow.
He's really skinny. And then his final weight we lifted was... It was 15 and a half kilos, which is maybe like 35 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just for comparison, what was your starting weight at the Olympic finals?
Like 300 and...
That's it. That's all you got to say.
That's all you got to say. That's all you got to say.
We believe you.
We believe you, yeah.
Mary Tyson Lappin, it is just a pleasure to talk to you about what you do. And we have asked you here, though, to play a game that this time we're calling
The Bad Kind of Listing.
So, you're an expert on weightlifting, as we have been discussing, but what do you know about shoplifting? Correctly answer two of our questions about the five-finger discount, and you'll win our prize, one of our listeners. Bill, who is Mary playing for?
Jessica Nelson of St. Paul, Minnesota.
Ready to go?
Sure.
Here's your first question. We also have three of these, three tries at this, so you're used to this sort of format.
Yeah.
Right. Here's your first question. Not every shoplifter is caught, but a man in Scotland who stole a bottle of vodka from a liquor store was almost immediately apprehended because he did what? A, he took two steps out of the store, guzzled the entire bottle, then passed out right there. B, asked the cashier on a date and left her his full name and telephone number. Or C, came back 20 minutes later and said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to steal some tonic water.
I'm gonna go with B.
You've met men. Yes, you're right. Yeah, you know. All right, here's your next question. You handled that well. That was an easy lift for you,
as it were.
When a security guard at Target once caught a teenager shoplifting, as he said later, he didn't want to, quote, ruin a kid's life for stupid mistakes. So what he did was he just called the police department. They said, send over an officer and just give this kid a, you know, scared straight type speech. One problem. What? A, they took him literally, and a film crew from the Scared Straight TV show came along, so no, everyone knows what she did. B, the officer that showed up to give her a talking to was her own stepfather. Or C, the policeman walked out with the candy bar she stole without paying for it.
Oh, gosh. B?
Okay, C. No, wait a minute. They're saying C.
Okay, I'll go with C.
You're from Wisconsin. They're Minnesotans.
True.
I'm just saying.
My sister lives in Minnesota.
Your sister lives in Minnesota.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying there is a rival.
Let's go with C.
You're going to go with C. No, actually, it was her stepfather.
Oh.
Yes. All right. This is what happened. A Target store in California. Somebody runs out with hundreds of dollars of merchandise, just runs right out the door. And a customer at the cash register asked the cashier, why don't you do something? Why'd you let that person go? And the cashier says, oh, well, that's just because Governor Newsom has changed the law, so like stealing that much doesn't even count as a crime anymore. What did the customer do in response? A, say, fine, ran out, caught the shoplifter himself, and then brought him to the police station. B, put his own stuff, you know, back in the cart and then rolled that out without paying. Or C, just stared at the cashier until she realized that he, in fact, was California Governor Gavin Newsom.
Okay, let's go with C.
You know, with C, that's what happened. It's true. Governor Newsom told this story himself. He was not happy about it. What happened was, once she realized it was Governor Newsom, she was like, oh my God, Governor Newsom, can I get a selfie with you? And he said, I would actually like to speak to your manager.
Oh, man.
Bill, how did Mary do in our little competition?
2 out of 3, Mary. That's a win. Good list.
You did it. You got the third one. Mary Tyson Lappin. He's a champion weightlifter who won gold at the Pan American Games before going to represent the U.S. at the Paris Olympics. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. What an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I need something heavy to keep me moving in the right direction.
You know how after Thanksgiving is over, you can't wait to sneak into the kitchen at midnight and make a sandwich out of the leftovers? Well, that is basically what we are doing this week.
Peter, I've always thought of you as the leftover turkey of public radio.
Well, here are two more essential ingredients for this midnight snack. First up, in May of this year, we talked to Lyndon Barrois, who had become well-known for his brilliant miniature sculptured figurines.
You might be thinking, well, we're all nerds here. We all make little figurines down in our basement. But what makes Barrois special? is what he uses to make them.
Little bit of a fact check here. I referred to you pretty confidently as the greatest living artist who works with gum wrappers. Are there any others?
No, I think I'm the only one on the planet, actually.
Right, yeah. All right, I think we just need to go right back to the beginning and ask you how you got started doing this.
As a kid in New Orleans, you know, I just grew up making things all the time, you know, out of, you know, discarded phone wire, aluminum foil, you know, anything I got my hands on, you know, clay. And then, you know, when of the tons of gum that my mom chewed, and I discovered, you know, her discarded wrappers were paper on one side and foil on the other, I had the idea that if I sculpted it with the paper side out, I can color it. And boom, the light switch went off and, you know, here I am.
Right.
It got me here.
I know. In your magnificent mansion made entirely of gum wrap. And this is where the only one of my few times that I'm sad I'm on the radio, because I would love for people to instantly see these. But what people need to understand is, like, these are not, I don't know, little stick figures. They're incredibly detailed, miniature, full body portraits. Oh, he's holding one up now. Yeah. And the two you're holding up are football players. And was that what you, yeah, was that where you started? Because I know that one of your first major projects was football, right?
Well, yeah, that was the first solo show I had. But I actually started just from making drivers for Hot Wheels cars. So because, you know, the cars are so cool, you know, the doors open, the hood, the trunk, everything, but there's no driver, so it made no sense to me. And so I just started making people to put in the car and never stopped.
Did your mother, like, up her gum chewing to provide you with more raw material?
She did, but then the doctors told her she had to stop because she'd swallow it and said, this is not healthy, man.
Wow.
That's like the low point in your Behind the Music.
Exactly.
You have a day job, which is you do animation and special effects for Hollywood films, some very, very big.
Yes,
Hollywood.
That has been the bulk of my professional work. I'm responsible for the creature work, the character and creature work. So, like, I've done everything from the Matrix trilogy to Happy Feet, the CG creature effects in those films, the ones that are brought to life, the actual characters themselves.
I can't let you go without asking about what must be your masterpiece. I refer, of course, to Karate Dog.
Oh, my God!
Were you aware, because we looked into this, that Karate Dog, of course, a classic, but there are some people who are unhappy with Karate Dog because, despite the title, the dog only does karate twice.
Wow, I can't imagine. I never heard that criticism.
Linda Barwai, it is fascinating to talk to you, and we have, in fact, invited you here to play a game we're calling...
That there is a really big sculpture.
Since you create very tiny sculptures, we thought we'd ask you about big ones. Answer two out of three questions correctly about very large works of art, and you will win our prize for one of our listeners, any voice they may choose from our show. Bill, who is Lyndon Barwat playing for?
Larry Sylvester of San Francisco, California.
All right. You ready to do this?
Yeah, okay. I hope I don't blow this.
Okay. The ancient Olympic Stadium in Greece, where they had the Olympics, had a row of giant statues outside. Those statues served what purpose? Was it A, they were each posed as if they were doing a particular athletic event, showing which way you had to go to see that event? B, the names of athletes who had cheated were inscribed on them as a badge of shame? Or C, their arms and legs were posed to spell out the letters in Olympics, like, you know, the YMCA dance?
What? I'm going to say A.
You're going to go say A, that, like, if you wanted to go see the javelin, you went over to the statue that was holding the javelin and you went that way. No, it was actually B. They if you cheated at the Olympics, they inscribed your name and what you had done onto the statues so that people would know and you wouldn't compete again. It was the ancient Olympic version of a photo by the cash register. Like, don't let that person in here. That's okay. You still got two chances.
Yeah.
So once one of these big monumental statues goes up, it's rarely changed. One exception is the very big statue of the Duke of Wellington in Glasgow, Scotland. What change was recently made to that statue? Was it A, because historians finally proved his horse had been a mare, not a stallion, certain items were removed? B, there is now an orange traffic cone permanently atop the Duke's head? Or C, after a sponsorship deal, his Wellington boots were replaced with Uggs?
I gotta go with A on that one. They had to have made him a gelding.
The audience is what is the audience yelling?
B.
The audience is yelling B, the orange traffic cone. I'm just going to lay that in front of you.
B.
Yeah, B. They were right, and now you are, too.
B.
So what happened was, sometime in the early 1980s, for reasons no one exactly knows, people just started putting this traffic cone on top of the Duke's head, and they'd take it off, and immediately somebody would come up and put another one on it. And it was such a pain in the ass to climb up and get it that they said, you know what? From now on, that's part of the statue. Problem solved.
I love this because I'm learning things.
You are, you know?
Yeah.
I know what your next sculpture will be. All right. One of the most famous large statues we have is Bob's Big Boy, whose figure looms over many of their franchises. That big statue played an important role in someone's life once when what happened? A, author Norman Mailer said he stopped drinking finally when a Bob's Big Boy looked down at him and told him to straighten out. B, Patricia Arquette told Nicolas Cage she would only marry him if he could bring her a Bob's Big Boy statue. Or C, all of the customers of a Bob's Big Boy were saved from the 1966 Topeka tornado by hiding inside him.
B.
You're going to go for B. You're right. Yeah. Patricia Arquette told the story that Nicolas Cage had wanted to marry her for a long time, and she said, fine, if you want to marry me, you must complete this quest, and gave him a bunch of things, including J.D. Salinger's autograph and a genuine Bob's Big Boy sculpture. And he did it, and they got married and lived very happily for about 4 years. But let me ask, Bill, how did Lyndon Barois do on our quiz?
Lyndon got 2 right, and you have won. You have won a little tiny statue that we're going to be sending you.
Lyndon J. Barois Sr. is a sculptor, artist, and animator. You can learn more about his remarkable work at itsarapper.com. Lyndon Barois, thank you so much for joining us. You're a genius, and we love talking to you. Take care.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was too much fun.
It really was. Take care.
Finally, here's an interview with actor Maya Hawke, who also joined us in May, and talked with guest host Alzo Slade.
Now, Ms. Hawke had also put out an album of original songs, so Alzo asked her what came first, singing or acting?
I've done them both my whole life. It's a notoriously terrible career choice. It's like you try to do one thing well, and then you're like, hey, look, I can do another thing badly, and then everyone makes fun of you. But it's fun, and I've been doing it forever.
So you've been a singer-songwriter forever, like when you're like 4 or 5 years old? What are we talking?
We're talking like 7, 8, but I was not a professional child in any way.
What were you writing at 7, 8 years old?
I was rewriting the lyrics to songs from the Hannah Montana TV show.
You were dropping remixes at 7, 8 years old.
Nice.
So Stranger Things is what most of us know you for, and you entered in the 3rd season, and this show was like the most like streamed show in the history of streaming forever throughout all eternity.
True.
And when I watched Stranger Things, it was nostalgia for me because I grew up in the 80s. But you're much younger than me. You're 25 years old. How did it feel playing a character that works in a mall that when malls really don't exist anymore?
You know, it felt a little bit like, you know, being on the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria. You know, it felt really good.
Yeah, my people weren't on any of those ships. So Stranger Things is so popular, and people there are some people who didn't want spoilers, didn't want to know what happened, but then there are people online really trying to figure out what was going to happen in the next episode. Were people, when people see you in public, were they kind of, you know, jolt you to try to figure out what's going to happen?
They do it all the time, even today, about the upcoming season. But the good thing about me is I can't understand what's happening in the show whatsoever. Even if I wanted to.
Maya, I saw the trailer for your new movie, Wildcats. It looks beautiful. It looks amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about what the movie is about and the role that you play?
Yes, I play like at least five roles in the movie. I play Flannery O'Connor and characters in many of her short stories. And if, for those who don't know, she's an extremely complicated, curmudgeonly, unpleasant woman from the Jim Crow South who wrote a lot and also died of lupus. Wow. That's my pick.
That was quick. And
we want to see
Thank
that.
You.
Yeah, we want to see that.
When I was in college, I was already obsessed with Flannery O'Connor or drama school, and I had a boyfriend who wrote me a song about it, and the last verse of the song was, "The only thing I knew about Flannery O'Connor was that she died of lupus, just like her father."
It's a solid approximate rhyme.
Is that on the soundtrack?
It plays over the closing credits when they do the big dance, the big Flannery O'Connor dance.
Maya, do you have a favorite lyric of yours? Like, if you had to choose one of your favorite lyrics from one of your songs, what would it be?
It would be from a song that's not out yet, but that's going to come out, which is a lyric I stole from something that my grandfather always says, which is, "Why do it right when you can do it yourself?"
I like
nice.
Granddad.
That's cool. Yeah.
That's some real wisdom right there.
Yeah.
That's some real wisdom. Maya Hawk, we've invited you here today to play a game we're calling...
Oh, my. A hawk.
Yeah.
That's right. We're going to ask you three questions about bird watching. Answer two out of the three correctly, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is Maya playing for?
Liz Price of Denver, Colorado.
Liz, I'm so sorry.
You're going to do great. I can feel it. Here's your first question. Urban birders can get amazing video if they're lucky, like one person who got footage of a crow doing what? A, cutting a car's brake lines, B, sorting a neighbor's recycling, or C, goading two cats into fighting each other.
Ooh, okay, I love crow stories. Crows are amazing, and they do amazing things, and so I'm gonna have to go with, because of my extensive crow research, with B, sorting a neighbor's recycling.
The answer is C.
No!
Yes.
Man.
Goading two cats into fighting each other. These two cats are opposite each other on two shed roofs, and the crow keeps flying back and forth, poking them on the butt to push them toward each other until they start going at it.
Do you think the crow had money on it?
Probably so. Yeah. All right, Maya, here's your next question. Birding may seem like a calm and relaxing hobby, but that's not always the case. Some birders have reported spotting birds doing what in the wild? A, screaming cuss words. B, trying to convince hikers to buy them a pack of cigarettes. Or C, selling tickets to watch two cats fight.
Okay, that's extremely funny, but I'm gonna have to go with A, though I think it's a gimmick.
Correct. The theory is that captive birds who learn to swear escaped and taught the wild birds all their dirtiest words. All right, Maya, here's your last question. A reporter uncovered a questionable tactic used by birders in Rhode Island to see birds who rarely fly close to the shore. What do they do? A, send out a rubber raft full of bird seed and then reel it back in like a fishing line. B, buy tickets on a whale watching cruise, only look at birds, then hope they never see a whale so the company refunds their ticket. Or C, play loud recordings of boat noises so the birds think they're still over the ocean.
I'm going to go with the whale watching.
Yes.
Nice.
Nice.
B, the whale watching cruise. Bill, how did Maya Hawk do on our quiz?
She did great. 2 out of 3. And Maya, that is a win.
Oh, see? Ladies and gentlemen, Maya Hawk's new movie, Wildcat, is in select theaters now. And her new album, Chaos Angel, is out May 31st. And Inside Out 2, an animated movie, is out June 14th. Maya Hawk, thank you for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody you heard on this week's show, all of the panelists, our guests, also Slade for guest hosting, and of course, Bill Curtis, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll be back next week with a new show.